This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Sure, the one undertaking I made is as a result of Shavuos. I have an interesting relationship with everybody on Shavuos night. I give a very good shiur on Shavuos night, and everybody falls asleep on Shavuos night. And the one time in the year where I don't mind if people fall asleep in the shiur, the one shiur that I doesn't bother me at all, because one of the reasons that we stay up learning all night is on Shavuos is because everybody fell asleep while the Rebbeinu Shalom was giving the Torah at Sinai. So I figured to myself that if everybody fell asleep when God was giving the Torah, there's nothing to get upset about if somebody falls asleep while I'm giving Torah. Still, obviously, it doesn't make any difference. So that's the custom. The only problem is there's no tape either on Shavuos night. So various people who through their day's state picked up various points in the shiur suggested that we repeat the shiur, which I undertook to do. And I also undertook in the late issue today to continue with the late issue. So that creates a bit of a difficulty, as you can imagine, but we're going to do both. We're going to do both. And but in order to continue with the late issue, I have to repeat a little bit of the late issue. So it's more important, in fact, that the men should be here and the ladies should be here. Because at least half of it the ladies heard, the men haven't even heard half of it. The only thing I must warn you is don't think that because I'm repeating a shiur that you can fall asleep again. Because, A, you'll miss it the second time there. And B, obviously even in a repetition, there are things that get further expanded and further explained and developed. We started off with the Gemara in Shabbos Daf Peches. Omer Rabbi Elazar, b'shor shehikdimu Yisrael naaseh l'nishma. At the moment that the Jews put naaseh before nishma, when they said we will accept the Torah and listen to it, putting acceptance before hearing, yotzeso basko, a heavenly voice went out v'omro lohen and said to them, Mi gilo levonai razze shemalochi ashores mishtamshim bo. Who revealed to my children the secret which the angels of God use? The stiv, as it says, Baruch Hu Hashem Malachov Gibore Keach, bless God, his angels of powerful spirit. I say, Devoro lishma bekol devoro. They who do his word to listen to his voice. To listen to his word. Bereisha, I say, first they do, v'hoda lishmoya, and they listen afterwards. So we see that that same principle of naaseh v'nishma, of putting acceptance of doing before hearing and understanding, is a principle which the angels followed. And Rabbi Elazar says that the heavenly voice went out with amazement at the time that the Bnei Yisrael said that. Where did they get to? Where did they get to such a level from? Where did they get to such an understanding from that enabled them to say naaseh v'nishma, to say first we shall do and then we shall hear? And on that we ask that the amazement, the astonishment of Shemayim, of heaven, is difficult to understand. What's so incredible about a people who had reached the depths of despair, the depths of tumor, the depths of defilement, the depths of hard labor and torture as they had received in Mitzrayim? And all of a sudden, after centuries of this kind of torture, after many, many years, after decades of torture, centuries of being there in Mitzrayim, they are brought out miraculously by a God. The Egyptians are smitten 10 times with one plague worse than the next. They are then taken out in a most miraculous way, in full view of everybody. Nobody interferes with them, not even the dogs bark, nothing. They're taken to the Red Sea splits, they cross the Red Sea. As the Egyptians come after them into the Red Sea gets covered over the Egyptians and kills them. They're now stuck in a desert with nothing to eat, Mon comes down. They're in the desert with nothing to drink, there's a miraculous well that appears from Miriam's well. Whatever they need, they get. They want meat, the Slav comes. Whatever they want, they get. When they're finally brought after 49 days to the feet of Har Sinai, and God says to them, will you accept the Torah? They say, nicer than Ishmael, we'll do whatever you say, anything we'll do, we'll listen afterwards, we'll do. Is that so difficult to understand that a people should make such a statement after what they've been through? Wouldn't any of us do exactly the same? Having been saved and having being brought out of bondage in such a situation and so miraculously, wouldn't any of us be any too glad to commit ourselves totally to He who saved us? So what's such a great thing of nicer than Ishmael? It would be great under normal circumstances, it would be great if they were living comfortably in Lower Hatton, and the Ribbono Shel'olam took them from Lower Hatton into a desert and wanted to give them a Torah that would restrict their liberties. And if they would say nicer than Ishmael, then I would understand the angels getting all excited. How did it happen that people from Lower Hatton taken out into a desert and have their freedoms restricted should say nicer than Ishmael? But these Bnei Yisrael who'd been through what they had been through and were saved in the way, in the miraculous way that they were saved, what's there to say nicer than Ishmael about? What's there to say, get so excited about their having said nicer than Ishmael? And we did in fact the Gemara about Unculus, which strengthens the question, strengthens the difficulty. Unculus by Clonimus Igia, the famous Unculus, the translator of the Torah, was originally not Jewish, and he converted to Judaism, and it's his translation, which is the only one of the only two authentic translations of the Torah which we use today. Unculus was the first person to translate the Torah authentically. And he originally was not Jewish but became a gay. Shodar Kesar Gunda de Romoya Basra. He was also a prominent person in Rome before he became Jewish, and it was an embarrassment to the Roman government that there should be somebody who went and converted to Judaism. So they sent a band of soldiers after him. Mashchin Hu Bikroi. He attracted them with Psukim. He taught them Torah. And through the Torah that he taught them, he was able to attract them. Igur, and as a result of that learning, they too converted. Hado shada gunda deroimai achrino abasu. This, of course, caused great consternation in Rome. But they didn't give up, and they sent another band of soldiers after him. Omar Luhu, that this time the senior person in Rome, there, the Caesar, said to this band, Lo temrele velo midi. Don't say anything to him. Don't get involved in discussion. Don't say anything to him. Ki avushatlu the azlu. By the time they came and they went, Omar Luhu, he said to them, Unculus said to them, Eimalechu milta, let me tell you something. You've obviously been forbidden to talk to me, but you weren't forbidden to listen. Let me tell you, let me say a word before you go. The Alma in the world, Nifyora nokat nirakama pifyora. A junior officer carries the light in front of a senior officer. Pifyora le duksa, and the senior officer carries it in front of the duke. Duxel Hegmona, and the Duke carries it in front of the senior general. Hegmona Lekuma, and the top general carries the lantern in front of the king. Kuma minokat nura mekame inshi? Does the king bear the light in front of anybody? Does he carry it? Does he show anybody the way? Amrilelo? So they said, no, the king doesn't. Amaluhu, he said to them, Akadosh Baruch Hu nokat nura kame Yisrael. Not so God. Our king carries the light in front of us. Doesn't work the other way around. It's not that he sits at home and sends us out to carry the light in front of him. He stands in the front and he shows us the way. And Hashem walked before the Bnei Israel during the daytime. Igur Kulu, they all converted. They were so amazed and astonished by such a religion and such a system, whereby the more senior one got, the more responsibility one took, even in little things, that they converted. Hoda shada gunda achrine abasre. Again, the Caesar decided to try once more and send somebody after him. Omalu leitishto midi bahadeh. This time he said, listen, not only don't you talk to him, but you don't listen to him either. Just have nothing to do with him, whatever. You go and you fetch him. That's all. No conversation. Ki naktile, when they came, the ugly, and they went to take him, chazo mezusta. The Zamancha apitche. Unculus, as they were schlepping him out of his house, he saw the mezuzah on the door. Oisiv yodayol. So he put his hand on the mezuzah. The Omar Luhu, and he said to them, "My high, what is this? What do you think this is?" Amrulayim alanatis. They said, "Say, you tell us." Unculus was a very clever psychologist. He realized that if he went into any direct conversation, they wouldn't talk to him. So he did it sort of round and about. What's this? So now their curiosity is aroused by the mezuzah. What kind of thing is this mezuzah? They're interested. They want to know. So here they asked him, "Tell us what it is." Amaluhu, so he says to them, "Min hagir shel olam, it's the minag in the world. Melech basal v'dom, a human king yoshev mi bifnim. He sits at home in the palace. The avod of mishamli moisim mibachutz, and he has the guards that stand guard outside his palace. V'ilu hakadosh baruch ha avod of mibifnim v'hu mishamram bachutz." But with God, it works the other way around. He leaves us peacefully sitting at home. We sit securely in our homes. And He stands at the door and He guards us. Shneimar Hashem Yishma Tzetzcha V'yecha Me'ata V'yadilom. God guards your coming and going from now and forever. Igur, they also converted. Tulo Yishoda Basra, he didn't send anybody else after Unculus. At that point, he left Unculus alone. In any event, what do we see? That they were attracted to Yiddishkeit. One of the things, each one that attracted them to Yiddishkeit is quite amazing, but one of the things that attracted them to Yiddishkeit was the pasuk which Unculus quotes to them, that Hashem hoylech lifneim yoimam, that God goes before them during the day. Unculus simply told them what happened thousands of years before, that when they were coming out of Egypt, the Ribbono Shel'olam actually led the way. He didn't just give them a map, and he didn't just give them navigational aids and tell them where to go. He stood in front of them and he led the way. They were so impressed by that and so amazed by that, that Roman soldiers, that is like Jews living in Lower Houghton, people from Rome who had all the luxury and everything that they wanted, what happens to them? Having heard that igyo, they convert, they accept Yiddishkeit. So what's so amazing about the Bnei Yisrael? They had no religion, they had no culture, they had no country, they'd been slaves, they'd been miserable. God brings them out, they accept Yiddishkeit. And they've seen God walk in front of them all day. They've seen the pillars of fire, they've seen the pillars of smoke, they saw the Red Sea split, they didn't hear about it, they saw it. They saw the Mon come down, they saw the water, everything they saw. Such a big thing for them to accept the Torah, to say, "Nice of Ishmael." Even these Roman soldiers were prepared to accept the Torah, having been told the story of Hashem Hoylech Lifneim Yoimam. And so we explain the principle of Na'aseh V'Nishma. And we said, in human communication it's difficult enough. To really understand what another person is saying is extremely difficult. We've often talked about it, how people don't always say what they mean, and they don't always mean what they say, and it's part of the faults of our society that we interrelate with one another on the superficial appearance of how things are. If you say to somebody, you're passing somebody walking, and you stop your car, and you say, "Would you like to lift?" And he says, "No, thank you, don't worry." You say, "Okay, bye," and you drive off. Meanwhile, he's dying for a lift, if he was too embarrassed to say, "Yes, thank you very much, I would." And you didn't even notice it, that really he wanted you to say, "Come on, don't worry, where are you going?" And then he gets into the car, if you've been that sensitive that you've actually insisted, he gets into the car, and he says, "Where are you going?" He says, "Don't worry, drop me wherever you're going." He says, "No, tell me where you're going." He says, "I'm going to town." "Where about in town?" "Where are you going?" "I'm going to the Jeppe Street Post Office." "Oh, that's really good, drop me at the Jeppe Street Post Office." So you drop him at the Jeppe Street Post Office, meanwhile he has to be in Commissioner Street. He's sensitive enough not to take you out of your way, and you're insensitive enough not to notice that he's sensitive enough. And that's how our whole lives go by. We just relate to each other on the most superficial of levels without really understanding what we're saying to one another. It's difficult to know what a person means. And that's in simple, superficial things. When it gets to really deep things, it's even more difficult to really understand what it is that we're saying to one another. Come, ladies, come in quickly, quickly. If you're quick, you can come and sit here in the front and you don't disturb anyone. You don't want to, you're scared. Okay. And that's just talking about ordinary people in the street. When it comes to trying to understand what Chachomim say, what the clever people are talking about, it's very much more difficult. Pick up a book by some profound philosopher, pick up a book by some profound scientist, try and understand what he's really saying, exactly what he means. It's extremely difficult. And when it comes to Chazal, you want to understand what a piece of Gemara means, what a Rashi means, what a Mishnah means, the work that has to go in to try and figure out what it means, and usually you still don't understand exactly what it means. You have an idea. But to really understand 100% what it means, there are not many people that can reach that level. To understand what God's talking about is impossible. To understand what God's talking about, you need to understand God. To understand what a human being's talking about, you need to understand that person. To realize that when he says, drop me at the Jeppy Street post office, he doesn't mean that, you've got to understand him. You've got to see that he's a sensitive person that doesn't want to take you out of your way. It's not good enough to understand the words. You can understand the words and misunderstand them, because you don't understand him. And to understand a piece of philosophy written by some kind of philosopher without understanding his general approach, you won't understand the words either. You need to understand the man, not just the words. In Torah, you need to understand Torah, you need to understand who the Chazal were, what the Tanoim were, what they mean. You need to understand how careful they are with every word. You need to understand their general direction and general approach. If you don't understand that, you won't understand the words. And to understand God, you need to understand God's words, you need to understand God, and that's not possible. So we find ourselves in a very difficult position of having to perform the Torah and accept the Torah without understanding it. Furthermore, assuming that they would have said, like the other nations said to God, well, tell us what's in the Torah and we'll tell you if we can accept it. And assuming then that God would have told them the whole Torah, or that Moshe would have told them the whole Torah, told them exactly what's in the Torah, and then they would have said, Naseh v'nishma, they would have said, Naseh, now we'll accept. Having heard, we will accept. That, as we've said, would be difficult enough for them. Really, to have understood what God wants of them would have been difficult enough, but not, it wouldn't have been as amazing as what they really did. What's the difference? In such a case, God's will has been reduced to words. It's been reduced, it's been expressed verbally. So when they say, we will accept, what are they accepting? They're accepting to practice the Torah as explained to them by Moshe. That means they're accepting something finite. They know what it is. It's been defined already. They need to study a little bit more to understand it absolutely, but they know they're not accepting anything infinite. It's like signing a contract with somebody. I agree to buy your house. I will take occupation on such and such a day, etc., etc., etc. The price you don't mention. And there's your agreement. Or you commit yourself to pay whatever price is demanded. And you sign it. It's an open-ended commitment. That means he can demand 10 million rand and you have to pay. Nobody does such a thing. Nobody makes an open-ended commitment. If the Torah would have been explained to them beforehand, there would have been something limited, difficult, deep, complex, but limited. It had already would already have been expressed, so it's limited. If somebody says now they want to accept the Torah, what is the Torah? I can say to them, look, there's Gemara, there's Shulchan Aruch, there's Tanakh, that's Rambam, that's the Torah more or less, Yerushalmi we've got, and that's the Torah. Okay, so he knows what he's going in for. How bad can it be? I mean, it's pretty big and there's a lot to do and a lot to commit, but he knows it's finite, it's not open-ended. He knows what he's committing himself to. But for them to have said, Naseh, before a word of this was printed, before a word of it was uttered, all they're accepting is God's will without having had it defined in any way by anybody. Not only wasn't it defined to them, but it hadn't been defined to anybody yet. They accepted it in its predefined state. They accept Torah before it was defined. They accepted Torah when it was infinite. They accepted Torah when it was boundless. That's the miracle that the Bat Kol couldn't get over. That they could have accepted something which is far beyond them and accepted to do it. And in fact, that is part of the segula, that's part of the specialness of what the Torah is. It enables one to do things that exceed one's own limitations. One's intellect is limited. The limitations aren't so narrow. One's intellect is pretty big if one would use it. But at the end of it, it's limited. Human intellect is limited. There are just things which are beyond human intellect. The human being is incapable of understanding God. The human being is incapable of understanding infinity. The human being is incapable of intellectually understanding eternity. The moment we get into the really spiritual and quantitative things, non-quantitative things, the intellect becomes unable to intellectually and academically grasp it. There are limitations. You can do that much and no more. Torah enables one to perform actions which are greater than one's intellectual limitations. You can perform an action which is the essence of God's will, although you are not capable of understanding the essence of God's will. That's what Torah enables you to do, and without Torah you can't. If you don't have Torah, on what basis are you going to act and react? On the basis of your own understanding of the world. That's as much as you can do. So at best you can be as great as your mind. There are very few people who are even as great as their minds. But the best you can possibly be in your action is as great as your mind. That's without Torah. No matter what it is that you want to do and how you want to do it and how great you are, you won't be greater than your mind, and your mind is limited. Through Torah it is possible in action to be greater than your mind. You can do things which are more infinite, more meaningful and much deeper than you are capable of conceiving even yourself. You can take steps into areas that you could never have thought possible of yourself. By doing it Al-Pi Torah, by working Al-Pi Torah. It is possible to work something out from the Torah so precisely and accurately that even though you don't understand its full significance, you know that's the Ratzon Hashem, that's what needs to be done. I'll give you an example. We're in the end of the... before the 1920s, just before the 1920s, there was a millionaire in Shanghai called Silas Khardun. He was a Jewish millionaire married to a Chinese girl. And one day he had a dream, one night he had a dream. His father appeared to him and said, "Silas, my boy, you're a big Baal Tzedakah." And Silas said, "Yes, daddy, I am." He said, "That's very nice, but I'm not very proud of you." And Silas was shocked in his sleep. "Why aren't you proud of me?" "It's because all the tzedakah is going to the goyim, to the non-Jews, but to your own people, what have you done? Surely your first responsibility is to your own people. The tzedakah you've done is very nice, the charity you've done is very good, but not if it's totally at the expense of your own family and your own people." So the next morning Silas got up very concerned, and he built a magnificent shul in Shanghai, in the Hongqiu area of Shanghai. And that was his gesture to the Jewish people, so as to satisfy his conscience after that dream. It so happened that the Hongqiu area of Shanghai started deteriorating as an area immediately afterwards, and it became a very low class area. It became the not even the business area, it became the like sort of the east side of New York, like the lower east side of New York there. It became like Dornfontein was before they started doing it up. Now it became really the neglected area where poor people used to hang around, and it was near the harbour. You can imagine what kind of area it was. And the Jews moved out to the northern suburbs. So the shul stood empty. And a lot of people thought at the time, poor Silas Khardun, his whole life he did nothing for the Jews. Finally he decided to do something for the Jews, build a magnificent shul, and they move away and the shul stood empty. Right through the 1920s, the shul stood empty. Right through the 1930s, the shul stood empty. For 20 years, the shul stood empty. In the early 1940s, in the end of the 1930s and the early 1940s, the Jews that had fled from Lithuania to Japan, to Kobe, were being expelled from Japan. They had to move out from Japan, and one of the only places they could go to was Shanghai. And tens of thousands of Jews started pouring into Shanghai, wave after wave after wave. The conditions were terribly difficult. There was no place. Shanghai was an overcrowded place before the Jews arrived, and certainly in the areas where the Jews wanted to live. The Jews came wave after wave, and there was no place for them at all. And each boatload that came was a tremendous burden on the existing community and on the existing refugee community. And people were taken, 20, 30 people into a house, 40 people into a house, until you just couldn't take another person into a house. And it was very bad. But eventually they found some kind of place for everybody, but with tremendous effort and expense. Then all of a sudden the Mira Yeshiva turned up in Shanghai. And there was just nowhere, absolutely nowhere. Nowhere whatever where this yeshiva could settle down. Somebody suddenly had an idea. The Hongqiu shul was empty. And the Mira Yeshiva moved into the Hongqiu shul. And it stayed there, and they learnt there, and they printed sforim there, they lived there, they ate there, they learnt there day and night. The Mira Yeshiva carried on in the Hongqiu shul, built by Silas Khardun. But the most interesting of all facts is that the number of seats in the shul was exactly the same to the last one as the number of Talmidim of the Mira Yeshiva that came to Shanghai. Exactly. So Silas Khardun built a shul 20 years earlier for the Mira Yeshiva. Did he know it? And when one looks back at the history of Torah, and the Miri Yeshiva was one of the important yeshivas that were saved, and one of the very, very few links that we have with the pre-war generation. One of the very, very few links in terms of institutional links. Who was there? There were the Briskers, there was the Ponovizhirov, the Chazanish in a way, and the Miri Yeshiva, that's about it. And in terms of an actual yeshiva that was completely transported, the Miri Yeshiva was the only one. And it had, and still today, has a certain character to it, which is reflective of yeshivas of those times. The only one that is not a modern yeshiva. It's very much of an old style yeshiva. So in a sense, our only yeshivish link with the pre-war generation was housed in a building built by Silas Chardum as a result of a dream he had 20 years before. One looks back and one says, Silas Chardum, what a brilliant step. 20 years before, to build a shul with exactly the number of seats as the boys from Miri Yeshiva. He didn't know what he was doing. He didn't think it out. It was impossible for any human being in 1920 to make plans for 1940. Who thought about such a thing? But Alpi Torah, on his little level, he did what was right. His father appeared to him in a dream, and he felt guilty, and he felt he should do something for the Jews. He didn't know what to do. He built a shul. It's possible to do an action which is much greater than any thought one can have. It's not just the thought that counts. Actions are greater than thoughts. People shouldn't say it's the thought that counts. The thought doesn't count that much. In the end, it's the action that counts. That's where one can really see the bigness of a human being, far beyond his own abilities and his own limitations. And that's what the Bnei Yisrael grasped and what they achieved. That they actually said, Naaseh, we're accepting something which is limitless, because we know one thing, the Torah, which means the teaching, is going to teach us to do that which God wants. And we know that it's our only opportunity and our only channel to doing more than we're able to conceive of. To make our own philosophies, that anybody can do. To practice that which we believe is right, that anybody can do. What we as a nation want to do is to have the ability to practice more than we know is right. To be able to actually project ourselves beyond our own intellects. To do that which is right in an absolute sense, irrespective of whether we're capable of understanding it. And more than that, we want to do things that we cannot understand. Something that one can understand somehow loses its bigness and its fascination. Once one has understood a thing, it becomes a little bit diminished. I think I told you of the occasion when I was in Korea and I was passing a very big sort of square that was built there. And I said to the taxi driver, what's this? He said, oh, this can hold 1 million people. I said, 1 million people? Have 1 million people ever gathered here? He said, yes, once. I said, what was the occasion? He says, Billy Graham came to town. And there were 1 million people here to hear him. I said, Billy Graham, can he speak Korean as well? I know that he can do a lot of fantastic things, but can Billy Graham speak Korean? He says, no, he couldn't speak. I said, did they have translators? He says, no translators. 1 million people came to hear a man, they couldn't understand the word? Yes. At exactly the same time, Reverend Moon from Korea was in America attracting millions of people, and he couldn't speak English. And all of a sudden it struck me that in religion today, people like what they don't understand. The moment they can understand it, it starts becoming simple stuff. They don't say, you know, how often do you find, it's not just today, it's even a little while ago it started already. If you hear a shiur that you can understand, what did he say to you? What's the chiddush? If you hear a shiur that you didn't understand the word of, it was fantastic, it was wonderful. What did he say? Oh, I didn't understand every word, but what a shiur. The man is brilliant. What a Talmid Chacham. How do you know he's such a Talmud Chacham? How do you know he wasn't talking nonsense? Oh, no. There's a certain fascination with not being able to understand what the man's talking about. And in a sense, there is something like that, except what we have to know is that not to understand anything, that's useless. What we need to know is that what we understand is only a little bit. It's a tremendous sense of arrogance to move away from an ordinary human being and think you've understood him. How much more arrogant is it to move away from a Talmud Chacham, particularly a Talmud Chacham who's prepared the shiur and prepared it carefully, and have any kind of feeling that you've understood exactly what he's trying to say, if he's a reasonably intelligent person? It's not possible that just in passing a few words you're able to understand exactly what he means to say. It's not possible. It needs a lot of work. And that the Bnei Israel realized. They wanted something which goes beyond. What I'm saying is there's a degree of emeskite in being attracted to something you don't understand. But that doesn't mean to say you must be attracted by confusion, and that doesn't mean to say you must be attracted by mystery. It just means that you are attracted by things which are greater than your intellect. That yes. And in Torah, although one cannot understand fully, we learned from the Vilna Gaon today, the different levels of understanding, but to understand pshat, Those of you learning Gemara know how difficult it is to understand Pshat. And when you've understood Pshat, the Vilna Gaon says that's just the Eka. That's all you've understood is the Eka. You haven't even heard the real thing yet. There are levels and levels and levels of understanding long beyond that. One needs to know at least that one can understand something clearly, and it's still it's just the tip of the iceberg. That's all it is that you really understood. Most of it is below the water. Not only most of it, but 99% of it is below the water. At best, we can just catch a glimpse of its most superficial meaning, but that we need to understand. If you don't understand the tip, then you're useless. Then you've got nothing at all. One needs to understand how to do and what to do, even if you don't understand the full reasoning for it. But you need to have clarity in what is required. That, yes. But at the same time, to feel as much as I understand, and I've understood as far as I'm capable of understanding, there is still a tremendous amount which is beyond me. That is something very exciting and very big about. And that's what the Bnei Israel wanted. This brings us to the big danger of Torah and of Yiddishkeit. And the danger lies in the fact that we're now dealing with something which is beyond us. We're now dealing with something which we cannot hope to really understand. We can only at best hope to partially understand it, and a very small partially. As meticulous a mathematical system as we have of figuring out from Torah what is right and what is wrong, still we're human beings. And as human beings, we can make mistakes. It's possible to make a mistake. How are we going to know if we're right or wrong? That's the main problem. When you're dealing with something you understand, you have a feeling as to whether you're right or wrong. But when you're dealing with something that you can't understand, how are you going to really know if you're right or wrong? If you come out, you're learning the laws of Kiddush, and you come out that you've got to hold the Kiddush cup upside down. That's how you've got to hold it. So you say, but it's unlikely to be like that. So you say, but look, Torah, we don't understand. It's all God-given, and that's what it says. It comes out that you've got to hold it upside down. So you'll start holding the Kiddush cup upside down. How are you going to know that's wrong? On what basis? That's how you figured it out. And believe you me, people figure out things that are even stranger than holding Kiddush cups upside down, and they don't know that they're wrong. It sounds weird, but it's not so weird. The answer to that lies in a mechanism which is very similar to a situation you'll find when a mathematics professor is lecturing to a class, and he says, right, try out, or he's giving them an examination, he says, do the following problem. This is the problem, and this is the answer, now do it. You said to yourself, oh, silly man, he gave us the answer already. He's not a silly man at all. He knows that if he didn't give you the answer, you would have no chance of getting it out. With the answer, you might get to it. So if he gives you the answer, what's the point in trying to get to it? That's mathematics. Mathematics isn't just getting the answer. Mathematics is how you get from the problem to the solution. It's learning the techniques of getting from the problem to the solution. That's what he really wants to test, and that's what he really wants to know. He doesn't want you wasting time going in the wrong direction. So he gives you the answer clearly, and he says, now get there. In Torah, we have a similar mechanism. What we need is some kind of test. We need somewhere where you can look up and you can say, now, I've come out according to this Gemara that you must hold the Kiddush cup upside down. What you need is some kind of thing that you can look up, Kiddush cup, hold Kiddush cup, right way up, I'm wrong. You need some kind of test to be able to figure out that my conclusion is incorrect, and you've got to start learning again to get to the right conclusion. And we have such a mechanism. The mechanism we have is described in the piece of Chumash that I did with you. You might say it's far-fetched to make such funny mistakes, but it's not. There's the story of Yosef when he was in Egypt working for Potiphar. And you will remember that Yosef was a very handsome young man, and Potiphar's wife fancied him. And she starts pestering him. Vayemoin, and Yosef refuses to have anything to do with her. Vayomer el eshes adoinovin, and he says to the wife of his master, Hein adoini lo yoda iti ma baboyes. You know, your master doesn't know what's going on in the house. Everything he leaves to me. I'm all the decisions I take. V'chol asher yesh lo nosan b'yodin, whatever he has is put into my hand. He trusts me implicitly. Einenu godol b'bayis hazeh mimeni, there's nobody more senior in his household than myself. And he doesn't hold back anything from me at all. Ki im oisoch ba'asher at ishtoy, excepting for you because you are his wife. There's a principle involved. He doesn't hold you back because he doesn't trust me. He trusts me in everything, and he would trust me with you as well. But you're his wife, and it's not right to do that, to give his wife into the hands of a stranger. So you are the one person that he doesn't allow to me any authority over. And how can I do this tremendous evil and sin to God? Now what does Joseph do here? On various levels, he explains to her why it's impossible. Firstly, I'm the most senior and the most responsible person in the household, and therefore it would be a lack of trust, a lack of faithfulness, if I did this behind his back. Secondly, due to his wife, it's immoral. And he understands that morality. If you would argue that he doesn't care about it and he's a liberated man, he's obviously not a liberated man. Because you're the one thing in the household that he won't let me touch. So you see that he regards you as his wife, and that it's got to be that way. So it would be completely immoral for me to have any kind of relationship with you. Beside anything else, it's bad, it's wrong, it's evil. One doesn't do such a thing. It's somebody else's wife, one doesn't do it. And furthermore, it would be sinning against God. Why does he need all these arguments? Why doesn't he just say, "V'chatosi le'elokim," finished? He should start off the very first argument. It's the first and the last argument. God says no. He doesn't say that. He starts off trying to persuade her morally and logically, or rather the other way around, logically and morally first. And he needs to carry on, not because she's not convinced. She's not going to be convinced until the very end. But he needs to carry on because he's not convinced. With the logic, he's not quite sure that it's so. It's possible, maybe, that it's not so illogical. Ah, but it's immoral? It's possible that it's not so immoral either. Egypt and the morals of Egypt, and maybe it's the done thing in Egypt. And after all, she wants it, nobody would know about it, what difference does it make? But at the end, he says, V'chatosi le'elokim, it would be a sin against God. Against that, there's no argument. The halacha says no, the Torah says you can't do such a thing, that's all. But in fact, and it was as she spoke to Yosef day after day, and he didn't listen to her, to lie with her and to be with her. It was on this particular day, when he came home to do his work, and there was no man of the men of the home there in the house. Says Rashi that there are two views as to what it means he came to do his work. Rav and Shmuel argue. One says he came to do his work. The other one says, no way. Yosef, a tzaddik, going to work in a house where there's a woman all by herself, everybody else, v'ein ish man she'abayis, they've all gone to the horse races, they're out all day. There's no man around there at all. The only person in the whole house is Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife has been pestering him in any event all the time. There's yichud, there's no question he wouldn't go into work. So why does he go in? What's he doing there in the house with this woman all on her own? Says the Gemara, Lasa tzochavimo. He was going to give in finally. He's actually going to go in and was going to have an affair with her. Yosef HaTzadik, who has just said, V'chatati le'elokim, it's a sin against God. So what's he doing going into the house now? Has he forgotten that it's a sin against God? Isn't he able to control himself, Yosef HaTzadik? Chas v'shalom. We had a shiur once before when I showed you that when a tzaddik falls down and commits an aveira, it's not because he can't control his yetzahara. The yetzahara operates with a tzaddik very differently to the way it operates with us. We sometimes do things knowing they're wrong. Do such a thing, a tzaddik doesn't. The yetzahara operates by distorting a tzaddik's view of what is right and wrong. It just blinds into one fact. You remember when we did the concept of bribery and blinding. That all the Yetzirah needs to do when a tzaddik is weighing up a situation is blind one blind spot. Just don't see one factor. And if you don't see one factor, your conclusion is going to be very different to what it would be if you did see that factor. Yosef at tzaddik had figured out that after all, it wasn't such an avera. It wasn't as bad as all that. He realized that she was an outstanding woman, and she was. And that great potential lay inside her, and that her descendants could become great people. And maybe after all, he worked out this, After all, her husband is a goy and she's a goy herself, and the Torah hadn't yet been given, and it was in Mitzrayim, and this and that and the other, and he rationalized and worked, even Yosef HaTzadik, that it wasn't a chet le'elokim, that it was something which was permissible. And that's why he goes in. If he goes in, what stopped him? So here Yosef is sat and he's worked. You can imagine what has been going through his mind and through his heart, and he's finally decided, I can do it. It's okay. He goes into the house, and he opens the key, and he walks into the house, and he knows that she knows that he's coming. Didn't take much on her part to know that he was weakening, and that this was the opportunity. The Durban July only comes once a year, and it's only once a year that everybody's out of the house, and this is the time. So he knows exactly where he's going to find her, and he walks towards her room, step by step. And as he puts his hand on the door and is about to turn the door handle, he stops. Says the Gemara, why? Because it says in the Torah, "Ein ish me anshe habayis sham babayis." There was no man of the men of the household there, but there was somebody else there. Yosef was caught out. As he was about to turn the handle, somebody else appeared. Who was it? The Musdukna Shalov, his father's image. I just saw his father shaking his head, and he walked out again, or probably ran out again. So what's happened here? Yosef has been able to rationalize away the logic. Yosef, how great! The great thinker Yosef, an intellect like we cannot imagine. The logic he's been able to rationalize away. Morality? Logic or no logic, it's not moral. The tzaddik, we call him Yosef HaTzaddik. Of all the forefathers, he's called the tzaddik. We don't call him Avraham HaTzaddik. We don't call him Yitzchak HaTzaddik, Yaakov HaTzaddik, no. Reuben, Shimon, Levi, not HaTzaddik. Yosef HaTzaddik is the only one who deserves that qualification, that description, that title. The tzaddik, the big moral person. The morality is also able to figure out. It's not immoral. So now he's left with a sin against God. Yosef HaTzadik, the man of religion, the man of integrity, the Yorei Shomayim, the man who's lived in Egypt all these years and hasn't deviated once from the Torah. What a tzaddik! He's able to rationalize that it's not an Aveira either. What stops him? Not logic, not rationality, not morality, not even religion, not even the Torah stops him. At the end, his own father that stops him. Father's a long way away, he hasn't seen his father for a long time. But he just saw his father's face of disapproval. And he realized immediately, I've made a mistake. I don't know where, I don't know what, but this isn't right. I'm holding the Kiddush cup upside down. This isn't the way to do it. How do I know it's not the way to do it? Because my father wouldn't have done it. That's all I know. And that's enough surety for me to know that I've made a mistake. Now we begin to see the importance and the vitality of the link with the past. The whole authenticity of Torah depends on the previous generation. The whole authenticity of your Torah depends on where you learnt it and on who taught it to you. And on the ability to see Dmus Dukno Shalov. The ability to see he doesn't approve. That's the only way that you're ultimately going to know that a thing is right or a thing is wrong. You can go right through the whole sugya. You can learn every part in Shas that has ever been written about it, with every Rishon and every Achron. You can go through Shulchan Aruch, through Rambam, through the lot with the Shailas and Tshuvas at the end. You can spend a year figuring it out and you can come to a conclusion. But there's got to be a way of testing, is my conclusion right? How do you know at the end of it that you haven't missed one point? You've got to just sit and think, what would my Rebbe say about it? If I told him that's the conclusion I'd reached, what would his face look like? Would he look approvingly? Would he smile with satisfaction at what I've achieved? Or would he shake his head, smile, maybe frown and say, no, that's not the way we do it. That's the Dmus Dukna Shel Ovid, without which one cannot move. So yes, one's dealing with Torah, in Torah, with something that is beyond one's intellect. One's dealing in Torah with something which is beyond one's understanding. One cannot fully understand what it is that the Torah is all about. But to be able to see that I'm basically going along the same lines as my father, that I can do. And I know that my father was doing the same thing, and his father was doing the same thing, and so back. So I know I'm more or less within the lines of the way Moshe Rabbeinu was when he learnt the Torah from the Ribbono Shel. That's that kind of security I need to have. And if I don't have that, I'm playing around with something which cannot be defined. I'm playing around with something that I will never know whether I'm right or wrong. And the whole purpose of an involvement in Torah is to know that this is right, this is true, this is truthful, and not to be confused. This way I can have such a certainty, I can be that sure. Because I'm able to see the most dukhma shel aviv and to know that's the kind of thing he would have approved of. The importance of the most dukhma is way beyond our appreciation. There's a very famous Yerushalmi which you'll now be able to understand. What we're talking about now is developing a relationship with the previous generation which goes beyond just learning from them. Because now what you need most of all from your teachers is the understanding of the man. To know what he as a man approves of and what he doesn't approve of. Be able to picture him clearly and know him clearly to be able to predict what he likes, what he dislikes. What he frowns at, what he smiles at. What he approves of, what he disapproves of. That's the most critical thing in this relationship. The Gemara discusses in the Yerushalmi in the fifth perek of Beitza, Halacha Beis, whether one's allowed to clap hands on Shabbos with the back of one's hands. Rebbe Avamesiv the Rabbi Shimon Bere. It was a Friday night, and Rebbe was sitting at the Sheva Brochas of Rabbi Shimon his son, having Sheva Brochas, and they were singing, and obviously there was clapping going on with the singing. V'havu metapchin la'achere yedeyun b'shivusa. And they were clapping with the backs of their hands on Shabbos, singing and clapping. Over Rabbi Meir, v'shoma kovin. Rabbi Meir walked down the street and he listened up, Sheva Brochas going on, and clapping hands. Omar, so he shouted up to them, Rabbi Seinu, Rabbi Seinu, Husra HaShabbos. Has Shabbos now been set aside for this wedding? Are you allowed to just do what you want now? Shomer Rebbe, Kale, Rebbe, the father of the Choson, hears the voice of Rabbi Meir down there. Omar, Miuzer Shebalir Doiseinu B'Soch Beiseinu. Who is this that is coming to oppress us inside our houses? What business of it is it of his, what we're doing inside our houses? In those days, everybody used to mind their own business. It was unusual for somebody to interfere in somebody else's affairs. Today, it wouldn't be so strange. Today, it's not unusual to ask what meat he eats, and what milk he drinks, and where he buys this, and what he buys that, and anything is allowed today. But in those days, the man, what was going on in his own home was his business. It was nobody else's business. And he says, who's this that's coming to chase us, to pursue us right into our house with the frumkeit? Won't even leave us alone. We're sitting in the privacy of our own house with the sheva brochas, and he's got to interfere. Who is that? Shomer Rabbi Meir Kale, Rabbi Meir heard Rebbe up there, the Orak, and he ran. He just fled. He didn't realize it was Rebbe sitting over there. Natkin Pari Basre Mafri. What a Talmidim of Rebbe, they ran after him. They got upset that their teacher was upset with Rabbi Meir, and they weren't going to let Rabbi Meir get away with this, and they started running after him. Just picture the thing on Friday night with Rabbi Meir, his black coat flapping in the wind, and these yeshiva bochrim running after him, and they want to get him. He's insulted their Rebbe. Afrach rucha fikaile mi'al kadli, the Rabbi Meir. And in the wind, his scarf got blown off Rabbi Meir's neck. And he was running and running, and he was running so fast, the wind untied his scarf and it blew away. Oidik Rebbe min kavse. Rebbe was quite excited by this whole thing, and he went to the window to look out. And watched the Talmudim chase Rabbi Meir down the street. The choma kadli, the Rabbi Meir min achirav. And he saw the back of Rabbi Meir's neck as he disappeared around the corner. Omar, he later said, Loizochis ano leoraiso. The heights I achieved in Torah was only elo begin the chami kadle de Rabbi Meir min achir. It's only because I saw the back of Rabbi Meir's neck at that moment. That's why I was able to achieve such heights in Torah. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, you remember the two chavruses, Tereyon Amrin, they both said, Anan lo izachinin lo araisa, our heights in Torah were only achieved. El begin the chaminon etzbo say the Rebbe min gul kikin the dile. Because we saw the finger of Rebbe sticking out of the sleeve of his, out of the end of his sleeve. That's why we were able to achieve what we were able to achieve. And another place is the same smice is brought, and it says, Rabbi says about Rabbi Meir, had I seen his front, I would have reached even greater heights. What do you mean to see the back of Rabbi Meir? Just to be able to picture the Talmid Chacham clearly and see him clearly, so that you're able to constantly feel yourself in tune or out of tune because of the image you have of him. And somehow, just by the way Rabbi Meir was running and seeing the back of his neck as he ran away, it was just so real and such a clear picture of the greatness of this man that never obviously moved away from Rabbi's mind. And his greatness later on he ascribes to having seen the back of Rabbi Meir's neck. And Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish ascribe their greatness to having seen Rabbi's finger. But that's the way it used to be. That's why, ladies, I suggested that you come closer, because you learn a lot from seeing, not only from hearing. To understand what one's talking about, to see the extent to which Torah is learnt, not just from the words, not just from the techniques, not just from the information, but from watching the little things. And not just in terms of watching the little things in order to learn how to do it, but in order to understand and picture the totality of the human being who is the teacher. So that you're always able to feel in an integrated way, does this fit in with him or doesn't it? And in order to do that, you need to know him. And if you know him, you'll immediately know that fits in or doesn't fit in. That's not the kind of thing he would say. I don't know why not, but it's not the kind of thing he would say. And I told you on Shavuos night how many times has it happened that I've scrapped shiurim, which I think are fantastic shiurim, better than many of the ones that I give, really good ones, and they get scrapped and thrown out. Not because I think they're wrong. They might well be right. I have no proof that they're wrong. I think they're right. But I just know that if I would say them to my rabbeim, I could just see the expression on their face, it doesn't look good. And for that they get thrown out. I don't even bother to then figure out what's wrong with it. The fact that my rabbeim wouldn't approve of that particular statement means that it doesn't fit in with Torah as I've been taught it. And therefore that particular shiur has no link with Sinai. It has no link with that Torah that was given on Sinai because it doesn't come from my rabbeim. So whether it's correct or not is irrelevant. It has no authority. And one dare not say something which has no authority, because then it's not Torah. The Gemara says in Avodah Zorah, there's two more. One, this Gemara, and then there's a very, very fascinating Gemara that we will do in Sanhedrin. Shalu lehechan holech. If you meet a gangster in the road, and he asks you where you're going to, you're taking a shirut in Israel, let's say, and a gangster gets in, and he says, "Oh, where are you going to?" Yarchiv leis haderech. If you're only going to Netanya, tell him you're going to Haifa. Tell him you're going a bit further than you really are. Kederech she'osa Yaakov avinu le'esav, as Yaakov did to Esav harosha. Dichtiv it says, Ad asher ovo el Adoni se'ira. I'm going to Seir, and it will take me a long time to get there. Why don't you walk ahead? He says to Esav, you go to Seir, and I'll meet you there. Uchtiv Yaakov nosa sukosa. And it says that Yaakov only went as far as Sukkot. He didn't go as far as Seir, and he never had any intention of going that far. Why? The reason is obvious. Because you've got to get away from this gangster now. My only hope you've got of getting away is to give him the slip. So tell him you're going to Haifa, and being a gangster, he won't have brought a Gemara along with him to read in the Sheirut, so he'll fall asleep. And when he's asleep in the Tanya, you get out, and he goes on, and that's the end of the story. That's the only way you'll get away from him. It's very logical and it's very simple. You would think you don't need the Gemara to tell you that, but the Gemara does. But not only does the Gemara tell you that, the Gemara even points out, and this is something which Rabbi Shulchan Shmuel Levitz points out, is that the Gemara says, "Kederech she'osa Yaakov avinu, do as Yaakov did." What do we need the proof from Yaakov for? It's such common sense, it's so logical. Says Rabbi Chaim Shmuel Levitz, there is nothing in the Torah which you can deduce from your own logic, because you're dealing with something you don't understand. And if it doesn't have a makor, if it doesn't have a source in your teacher's hanhoga, in the way that you've actually seen people act, don't necessarily think that it's right. As correct as it sounds and as logical as it sounds, you need to know Kederech she'osa Yaakov, that's how our forefathers did. That's a correct thing to do, it's a Jewish thing to do. We do that kind of thing. You need to know that. And then there's a Gemara which is even more striking. Listen to this Gemara, Sanhedrin Daf Yudalef. Maaseh b'Rabban Gamliel she'omar hashkimu li shivu la'aliyah. there was a case with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and he said, bring me 7 people up to my study, we're going to do Ibur Hashana. Umotza Shemoyna, and he found 8 people there. Omar Miul, Hushayallah, Shaloi Birishus. He said, who's here without permission? Again, in those days, these things went like railway stations. Nowadays, if there's a shir, you turn up, you don't go, you're invited, you're not invited, you say hello, you don't say hello, you come and you go as you please. In those days, it wasn't. He called together 7 people, and he wanted 7 people there, and that was it. He says, who's here unannounced? Somebody has come here without being invited, and he hasn't introduced himself to me. Omar Shmuel HaKotn, V'omar Ani Hushayallah, Shaloi Birishus. And said Shmuel HaKotn, it's me, I came. And I didn't come here to participate in your deliberations. I'm too junior to participate. I just want to see how you do it. And although I've learned the theory, I want to see it in practice. I want to see you doing it. And please excuse me for coming, but that's why I'm here. He said to Shmuel HaKotn, sit down, my son, sit down. All the years are fit to be declared leap years by you. You're one of the people of greatest stature among us. But there's a din that you can only, the only people who can declare the year a leap year are people who've been called together for the purpose. That's why I was particular. Says the Gemara, V'loi Shmuel HaKotn Hava. Do you think Shmuel HaKotn would have gone up there without permission? Never. Elini Shachrinet was one of the others. Umachmas Kisufa Huda Ovid. And he did it out of, and to avoid shame to the person who really did it. Okay? Also, a very fine thing to do and a very sensitive thing to do, but no big chiddush. It's very nice. Ki hoda Yosef Rebbe v'kodorish. There was a similar case where Rebbe was giving a shir one Motzei Shabbos. V'kodorish v'iriach reach shum, and he smelled somebody's been eating garlic. In nowadays, it makes a difference. You come into a shir chewing gum. Never mind having eaten garlic hours before, but in those days, chas v'shol, nobody would come in eating chewing gum, and nobody would come in if they've eaten garlic shortly before. Omar Misho Chal Shum Yetzei. He says, please, whoever's been eating garlic here, it's not derech eretz to come to a gathering where there are a lot of people. Please get up and go out. Omad Rabbi Chiya v'yotze. So Rabbi Chiya got up and went out. Omdu kulam v'yotze. So everybody went out. B'shacha metzor Rabbi Shimon b'Rabbi. We've just learned that Rabbi Shimon was Rabbi's son. Do you remember Rabbi was at Rabbi Shimon's Sheva Brochus when Rabbi Meir walked past? The same Rabbi and the same Rabbi Shimon. So that Rabbi Shimon next morning finds Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya Omar Leini Sesti Matoshi Tziyata L'Abba. Are you the one who had the chutzpah to come to the shir having eaten garlic and cause my father such tzar? Wasn't me. So why did he do it? For the same reason. He did it in order to not to cause shame to the one who was really responsible. He knew that if he got up and walked out, everybody else would walk out too. Those were also great days. That also doesn't happen today. For people, A, to be as sensitive as Rabbi Chiya, to realize I must walk out, not the person who really did it. And B, for everybody else to realize that it wasn't Rabbi Chiya. And therefore that we all have to walk out to save the person's shame. Because what would happen if Rabbi Chiya walked out? The smell would remain. And everybody wouldn't take very long to realize that it wasn't Rabbi Chiya. So what did he gain by it? Rabbi Chiya knew who his colleagues were. And Rabbi Chiya realized that they would immediately realize that it wasn't him. And that the only way that this man was going to be avoided the embarrassment would be by everybody walking out. And that's what happened. And Rabbi was right to throw him out. And they were right. And Rabbi Chiya was right to walk out. And so were they all right to walk out. Ask the Gemara of Rabbi Chiya Mehecha Gomilo. Where did Rabbi Chiya learn such a thing? Ask the Chaim Shmuel Levitz. What do you mean, where did Rabbi Chiya learn it? Is it such a difficult thing to learn? Answer the Gemara of Rabbi Meir. He learned it from Rabbi Meir. The Tanya, because we learned in the Brisa. Look at the string of events. So we had the case of Shmuel HaKotn, Rabbi Chiya, and Rabbi Chiya learned it from Rabbi Meir. The Tanya Maisev Ishacha Shebosu Levitz Midrosho Shor Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was also giving a shiur one month of Shabbos, and there was a knock at the door. And they opened the door. I don't know why they opened in the middle of the shir, but they did. And there was a woman there. No, it was probably a shir for women too. So they said, come in. She said, no, I'm not coming in. Omrali, she said, Rebbe, can I just stop you for a moment, Rabbi Meir? Echod mikem ki deshoni bevia. One of you people in this base of Medrash had a relationship with me with the intention of marrying me. Omad, Rebbe Meir v'chosav laget krisis. So Rabbi Meir got up and he called the secretary and he wrote out a get, a divorce, and he gave it to her. He gave it to her. So everybody else also wrote out a divorce and they gave it to her. Ask the Gemara, Rabbi Meir Mehecha Gomela. Where did Rabbi Meir learn to do such a thing from? It's amazing, is it? So difficult to do. It's sensitive, it's fine. But does he have to have a source for such a thing? Mishmuel HaKotan. He learned it from Shmuel HaKotan, as we learned. Shmuel HaKotan Mecha Gomilor. And where did Shmuel HaKotan learn it from? Mishchanya ben Yechir. He learned it from the case of Shchanya ben Yechir. And further on, the Gemara, Shchanya ben Yechir Mecha Gomilor, Mi Yeshua. He learned it from Yeshua. And some say from Moshe Rabbeinu. Asks Chaim Shmuel Levitz, why do we need such a source? Why is the Gemara so disturbed as to where these people learned it from? Answers Reb Chaim exactly as we've said, that in matters such as this, you've got to have a Kabbalah, you've got to have seen it somewhere. You don't just figure a thing out and think that you're right. Who says you're allowed to embarrass yourself? Who says that you're allowed to put your own integrity and reputation into question in order to save somebody else some difficulty? That one has to learn from a source. That one has to learn from somebody. And furthermore, says Reb Chaim, and this is the most beautiful part of all, he says, why didn't they all learn from Yeshua and from Moshe? What does it say that Rabbi Chia learned from Shmuel HaKotan, and Shmuel HaKotan learned from Shchanya, and Shchanya learned from Yeshua, and Yeshua learned from Moshe? Why didn't they all just learn from the first one? Says Reb Chaim, no, there's only one person you can learn this kind of thing from, and that's your own Rebbe. You can't pick it up from older history than that. You can't learn it from hearsay, and you can't learn it from Sforim, even if the Sefer is the Chumash. This is only something you can learn from having experienced it from your own teacher, from your own Rebbe. That's the only source that you can have for such information. This now answers the question we did in the Ladish Year. The people of Israel asked Shmuel to appoint a king. Shmuel was offended at the request. The people of Israel prefaced it by saying that he, Shmuel, was already getting old and his sons were not fit to take over from him, and they felt they needed a king. Shmuel was offended, but God tells him to go ahead and give them a king, and with all his dedication, with all his heart, he sets about selecting a king and getting this king recognized and accepted by the Bnei Yisrael. Just before his death, Shmuel decides to give them a little bit of Musa. He starts off by telling them that, have they any claims against him? Has he ever done anything that is not in their interests? Has he ever taken anything from them? And everybody accepts there's nothing at all. They have no claims whatever against Shmuel. He goes on to say that it wasn't right. They've rejected God by appointing the king, and they've rejected him by appointing the king, and he gives them a bit of Musa. And then he says, "Haloi ketzir chitim hayom." It's after all springtime now. It's the time of the gathering, of the harvesting. Ekro el Hashem. I'm going to call to God. The yitain koilos umotor. He's going to give thunder and rain. Udu uru and know and see. Ki roaschem rabo. Your wickedness is great. Asher asisem. That which you did, beina Hashem, in the eyes of God. Lish olachem melech. To ask for yourself a king. We asked this morning, what's the relevance of this? He's going to bring a downpour of rain in the middle of spring. Okay, so he'll show that he can do miracles. He'll show that he can pray to God and God responds. He'll show that he's not too old to function and that he could have done whatever any king can do. But what's the relevance of the rain in the springtime? And we said that rain is a wonderful thing. The Malbim says rain is wonderful. It's brocha, it's a sign of blessing, it's a sign of wealth, it's a sign of well-being. We pray for Geshem, we pray for Tal. It's important. The economy can't survive without it, particularly in Eretz Israel. There is no other source of water, and the whole economy is agricultural based. Rain is the most essential ingredient to a successful life in Eretz Israel. But rain at the wrong time, rain at the Ktzir Chitim, rain when you're busy harvesting, it can wreck your whole harvest. Says the Malbim, what Shmuel wanted to teach them is there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with choosing a king. A king can be a wonderful thing. And the Torah in fact makes provision for a king. The Torah recognized that there would be a time where the people of Israel would require a king. That's the Shmuel. Timing. It just wasn't the time. This isn't the time that you do such a thing. You wait. I was functioning alright. You've just said you had no claims against me. In no ways did I mistreat you. In no ways was I dishonest with you. In no way did I let you down at any stage. I'm getting on in years a little bit. I'm getting a little bit older. He says early on, I'm getting old because of you, because of my dedication to you. My children aren't fit to take over. That's because I had no time to educate them. I was dedicated to you. And now you have the cheek to turn around and reject me? That's not the right time. And Shmuel teaches a very important principle in moral behavior. That it's not only what you do, but it's also how you do it. And more important, it's not only how you do it, it's when you do it. One can choose to do something which is right and which is wrong. Let's set aside the wrong thing, so you're doing something which is good. Inherently, it's a good step, makes sense. But if you do it, you might offend somebody, you might hurt somebody. So you choose to do it in a way which will hurt him less, that's least. That's still not good enough. You have to choose the timing carefully too. And I said to the ladies that in each generation we've had something for which Mesiras Nefesh has been necessary. In Yiddishkeit, it's not Yiddishkeit altogether. It's too much to ask that we have to give our lives for every letter of Torah. We wouldn't survive if that was demanded of us. But in each generation it has been demanded of us that we need to make sacrifices for some part of Torah. Because if we're going to keep Torah without sacrifice, that's not Torah. To keep Torah because it suits us, to keep Torah while it's very convenient and comfortable and doesn't cost very much, that's not Torah. A commitment to Torah, a moral commitment, is when you have to pay for it. And you're still prepared to do it, and you still do it. That's when you've got a moral commitment. And there was a time when to keep Shabbos was a tremendous moral commitment. It was virtually impossible. One just couldn't make a living. And the few people taking this country itself, at the early years of the century, right until 20 years ago, the few people who were able to keep Shabbos, it was tremendous Mesiras Nefesh, it was tremendous dedication. And before that, before the war, dedication to learn Torah. Today, what's difficult to learn Torah? All you hear about, if you go into yeshiva, is the boys are complaining that the food isn't good enough. That's the biggest complaint you'll hear already. The food's not up to scratch. But apart from that, beautiful yeshivas with beautiful dormitories and facilities and funds available, and the yeshiva bochrim flying backwards and forwards all over the world to Israel and to America and back home for the holidays and back again. In those days, what it was, when my father went to yeshiva, it took him 4 weeks to get there. And every letter that was posted took 4 weeks each way. So it was 10 weeks before you got a reply to a letter. That was the quickest way you could communicate with your family. And when he wanted to buy a sefer, he went without a meal, because the amount of money that he had available was just sufficient to come out, just to come out. So he had to choose. If he wanted a sefer, he had to start saving up. The only way to save up was to cut out meals. Then you could buy a sefer. We don't have that anymore. Sforim are cheap, money is available, yeshivas abound, thank God. It doesn't require great acts of courage to go and learn for a couple of years. Anybody can do it today. And somehow there's a lot of siyata dishmaya in learning. People are able to concentrate better. They're able, altogether, somehow we're able to make progress in learning more easily than it could be done before. So that Mesiras Nefesh is gone. So what's the Mesiras Nefesh for today? What does one really have to stake oneself for and say, for this I'm prepared to give my life? Today it's not in the area of any of the physical, material expressions of Torah. It's not in the area of practicing Torah in the normal, conventional sense. It's in the area of practicing the morality of Torah, the midas of Torah. To develop a Torah character, to do or not to do that which is required by Torah, that's something which one isn't able to do easily, and something for which one has to sometimes commit Mesiras Nefesh. How does one develop the sense of timing? I think maybe I should leave it there. Which means I didn't quite keep my commitment to answer the question at the ladies' share. But perhaps we'll do that next week. I want to do two things with you next week. That is, firstly, how does one develop the sense of timing? Which obviously we've partly answered already. And because we're not talking about something that you can look up in any sefer. You can look up to see whether rain is good or rain is bad. But to look up whether in this particular circumstance, at this particular time, rain is good or rain is bad, that you can't look. It's not written anywhere. And if rain is bad now, when will rain be good? It doesn't say that anywhere. That's just a natural sense of timing that one has to develop. And how to develop that sense of timing, the Mitzvah we'll do next week. Together with that, and that is the big section that we'll do next week, which I was hoping still to finish tonight, but we're not able to, is the question of preventing a lack of originality. If it's so important, if the Demus Diuchnoi Shel Oviv is so important, this image of the father, this image of the Rebbe, is the thing which is going to be the guideline all the time, and that's what's going to determine the rights and the wrongs of what one does and how one operates. How does one prevent that from becoming stale? How does one prevent that from becoming merely repetitive? I'm just imitating what my teachers did. How does one retain originality while at the same time remain within this boundary that we've described? Let him be a session, we'll finish off next week.